The world of professional baseball faced a critical challenge during the 1978 case of Charles O. Finley and Company v. Kuhn, heard by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. At the heart of the dispute was if the Commissioner of Baseball had the authority to disapprove player assignments that potentially harmed the interests of the sport. The plaintiff, Charles O. Finley and Company, Inc., had players under contract with Oakland, who they planned to sell to other teams before the end of the 1976 baseball season. However, the commissioner rejected these transfer plans. He reasoned that the sales could hurt the competitive balance of the game, weaken the Oakland club, and disrupt baseball's reserve system. In the district court, the commissioner received support. It held that it was not within their jurisdiction to decide whether his refusal to sanction the sales was right or wrong. The court noted that he had acted in good faith, using the broad powers granted to him by the Major League Agreement to protect the best interests of baseball. However, the verdict did not sit well with Charles O. Finley and Company, who appealed the ruling. They cited errors during the trial and argued that the blanket waiver in the Major League Agreement, which prevented them from seeking recourse in court, was not enforceable. After considering the appeals and the intricacies of the case, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit upheld the district court's judgments. It agreed that the commissioner could invalidate player contracts not in the best interests of baseball. It also ruled the Major League Agreements Clause, requiring baseball clubs to resolve their disputes through binding arbitration and not in court, was valid and should be enforced. The case underscored the commissioner's extensive power in the world of baseball and the importance of private dispute resolution in preserving the sporting spirit. It showed that the interests of the game could be protected, even from legal challenges, by those with substantial stakes within it.
Certainly, I come from a biased perspective as a bigger market team, but I think that, you know, if everyone talks about, you know, the reason we play sports is competition and to win. And so now when you bake in the market, as I mentioned, the fans showing up, I think it's really impressive in the way it should be as far as us putting our money into the ball club, into the players. And there's revenue sharing that I don't want to speak out of turn, but goes to a lot of clubs. And I think the frustration for fans is their individual ball clubs. They want to have the same kind of motivation as Mark Walter, our ownership, does. And everyone's in their own particular situation and market. But I think that the evil empire sort of thing, I think people like to root against somebody, I guess. But I still think fans would like teams to invest in teams rather than to stand or sit on their hands. And I think Andrew said this a lot, is trying to make, and what we've tried to do is try to create a destination place, right? And I think that the late James Earl Jones said it best, you know, if you build it, they will come. And I think that we've done a great job of building something special that guys want to take a one-year deal or defer money to play for the Dodgers and for a chance to win a championship. So that's just a credit to the organization as well.
We're back. Lots to talk about. And what better way to bring in one of our Talking Mets contributors? If you guys remember, David Mills joined me back in the summer when we were talking a little bit about the Talking Mets top prospects. And, you know, we're back because there's a lot going on. You have Amazing Day, Steve Cohen, probably one of the more transparent conversations with the media, fans freaking out about the departure or potential departure of Pete Alonso. And also, you know, the Dodgers quietly, and we're not even talking about it yet, signed Kirby Yates, somebody that we were looking at here in New York. And are the Dodgers bad for baseball? And David Mills talked about that and brought some parallels to Bowie Kuhn and Charlie Finley and the Oakland Athletics. So, David, welcome to the program. And, you know, we'll start off with the Cohen, Stearns, Amazing Day. I mean, here was a whole thing, autograph session, PR, some, you know, cozy talk. And it turned out to where I think I've gotten, here's the feedback I've gotten. Some fans felt he was lecturing and disrespectful to the fans. And I think those are the fans that just want what they want. And then there are other fans, the vast majority, that said, hey, that's refreshing to hear an owner, because Stearns was more politically correct when he answered the Pete Alonso question. So, you know, where do you fall in? I basically said, hey, we learned that the Mets are comfortable with their young players. We learned that it's not necessarily the rumor mill coming from the teams. It's a lot of agent talk. And we learned that, you know, Stearns and Cohen are going to stick to their plan, and they're not going to be pushed by the media, the fans, this show, or anybody that's not employed by the ball club.
You know, well, glad to be on the show again. To get right to the answer, years ago, I read Herb Cohen's book on negotiating. And the crux of the book, you could sum up in one sentence, that when a negotiation concludes, which this one hasn't, both sides should walk away slightly unhappy. I think what we have here is both sides are extremely unhappy. And,
sure.
And I think that Scott Boras maybe didn't expect the kind of candor from the man who's ultimately paying the salary. Of course, the fans are ultimately paying the salary, even though a lot of fans don't realize it. And so now it's going to get into this next phase, which I think is really unfortunate in a lot of ways. And now fans are going to more intently turn away from, I think they're not going to turn away from the Mets. They're going to turn away from Pete. And that's unfortunate. But Pete's a big boy. I mean, he walked away from his previous representation. Why, we don't know, and maybe we'll never know, at least during his playing days. And now he's with somebody who has, you know, kind of a notorious reputation. And that notorious isn't necessarily a bad word. So I just think it's going to go to kind of these negotiations are now going in the absolute wrong direction. And I think Mets fans just have to prepare for another alternative to Pete Alonso.
And I said, and I wonder, and look, I love Pete. When I heard the negotiations were breaking down a week ago, I was bothered by it. I mean, there's been many homegrown players that have left. Jacob deGrom left just a couple of years ago. Look, I remember when Strawberry left. I don't know if I'd put Pete up with Strawberry, but I felt like, you know, compared to DeGrom left, they signed Verlander, and everybody was like, all right, let's move on. And DeGrom had this arm's length relationship, I think, with the entire city and organization. Pete is this bigger than life figure. He burst onto the scene. But I also wonder if that pop-up that he dropped in game three led to the Brewers blowing the game open, or even if it didn't and he grounded into a double play or he struck out or popped up in the ninth inning against Devin Williams, would we be having this kind of outcry by the fans? It's interesting because there was a lot of annoyance, especially after he fell down earlier in the series against Milwaukee and tripped over his bat. There's been a burgeoning annoyance by Alonso. And quietly, nobody really talked about it. He didn't have a great year. He's not hitting off-speed pitches at all. His production has gone down. He has never been a great first baseman, but he tends to, and you saw that, I think, in Game 6. He made a bonehead play against the Dodgers. He's on a bunt or something. There's a lot of deficiencies to his game. With that said, I think the Mets could use the bat, but I think the Mets are saying, hey, we could use the bat for this many years and this amount of money, and if it's not good enough, well, you know what, Pete, we love you, but go find somebody else. But I do wonder if there's some recency bias with the fans and Pete Alonso because of Milwaukee.
Yeah, I think, look, we all react more in the moment than we do in the, you know, so the moment is anything from the postseason to now. And I think a lot of fans aren't as tuned in as maybe the listeners to your podcast. So, you know, it's really a situation where if you look at Pete, I mean, I actually think he's a better first baseman than most people think. I think his trouble is similar to what other first basemen have trouble coming in on balls, throwing to second base. I was watching last night. They had a replay of the discussion and replay of the game 6 of the World Series in 1986. And, you know, I remember Bob Costa said something about nobody makes that play except Keith Hernandez. I mean, he comes on a bunt, he throws a bullet to second base. I mean, it was
that's Hall of Fame. So there's Hall of Fame, there's really good, there's below average. And I think Pete falls in more of the normal first baseman. And I think you'll probably, if Vientos is the first baseman in 2025, I think you'll see something similar with him. I think these are really tough plays. And
well, Vientos has a better arm. I have to tell you that this brings up something that I have to tell your listeners. And I was at a game with my dad. My dad was a New York Giants fan through and through. I mean, he was so upset when they moved out of New York that he just, for a few years, just stopped having any interest in baseball. And he, from the time he was 7 years old, his parents would give him like 50 cents and he'd go to the ballpark, to the Polo Grounds. He lived in the Bronx. They owned a delicatessen. And I mean, he'd take the subway by himself at 7 years old. Who would do that today, right?
Sure. No, today you'd know the helicopter parents wouldn't let it.
And we're sitting there at a Mets game, and he's telling me all about Bill Terry. He was a Mel Ott fan. He was a Bill Terry fan and all the great Giants of the day. And we're watching the game, and he's talking about Bill Terry, what a great defensive player was. In addition to, he hit 400. Keith Hernandez makes an incredible play, and he's talking about Terry, and he goes, and he was the best first, but he's the best first baseman I've ever seen until this guy.
Right. Wow.
One of his patented Keith Hernandez plays.
Wow.
I'd love to tell Keith that story someday. But, you know, Pete is a fantastic scooper of the baseball. And so people have been delving into the statistics on that. He had more chances to scoop than anybody. And that's mainly because Francisco Lindor uses the bounce pass.
Right. And that'll be a big thing for anybody who takes over. They're going to have to, you know, work on that. And that's
Absolutely.
Not easy, especially Absolutely. When that ball's coming at you at 90. I've seen Pete with like Vientos in particular, a 90 something mile an hour short hop. I mean, I'm talking a real short hop, but he just clips it. I mean, I think that will be something a little underrated part of his game that the Mets will miss. But David, you wrote during the summer the top prospects for Talking Mets. You're fortunate enough to have some contacts in the game and understand systems and have that exposure. And David Stern said pretty bluntly yesterday, hey, we're very comfortable going with our young guys. And even Carlos Mendoza brought up Acuna, which makes me wonder if Iglesias' days are over too. Another Boris Klein, he went to Boris. And I mean, that's the part I think the fans are uncomfortable with. And I'm personally uncomfortable with, because I know that 30 home runs and 90 RBIs is being replaced by Soto when you compare it 1-1. But when you put Soto and then you say you're losing Pete's bat and you don't put it 1-1, you're relying on Alvarez to improve, which he talked about yesterday about his plate discipline. You're relying potentially on Beatty to improve as a hitter, which is a big if. You're relying on Vientos to be par or better than he was last year. You're relying on Nimmo, who now has some health concerns with plantar fasciitis, which doesn't necessarily heal and can be debilitating and end a career, to get back to the run creator that he is. Center field, similar to last year, is going to be a defensive position. Is McNeil the second half McNeil that we saw, and not the first half McNeil? So there's a lot of ifs. Now, those things are not unreasonable to expect. And then you got the kids, the Gilberts, the Acunas. I don't know if Jet Williams will be ready, and so on and so forth. They're reasonable to expect, but they're not guarantees. And that's why I think this is a risk, because if they get off to a slow start and Soto's not getting anything to hit, or God forbid he gets off to that old New York slow start that we saw guys like Piazza and Beltran get into, this is going to get ugly, because I don't think the fans are going to want another OMG run from June 1st on. They want things to be a little bit cleaner from opening day to the end of the season. So they're taking some risk. And from what I see, they don't care. Stearns doesn't care. He's going to do it his way. He's almost like Frank Sinatra, the baseball Frank Sinatra here.
You know, I have a little bit different take, or maybe a little broader take in a sense, on why some of these moves are made, why he's willing to go with platoons perhaps at some of these positions at first base. I think that the signing of Jesse Winker is a really interesting signing. Why? Not just for the obvious reasons, which is probably to most people the DH situation, but Nimmo has plantar fasciitis. I've actually had that myself. I can't imagine how a professional athlete who depends on speed, and Nimmo's game, part of his game is speed. I can't imagine how they can play with this. Well, Winker comes in as ostensibly a DH, and he's willing to play first base, but he also, his best position in the major leagues, he was competent in right field last year, but his best position has always been left field. So he's a guy who could swap with Nimmo. If Nimmo needs a few days to just be a DH, Winker out there in left field, yeah, you're losing a little speed. He's probably got a – well, he does have a better arm than Nimmo. And he's more than competent playing left field. So there's some versatility in terms of your roster construction. At the same time, what has happened now is they have two left-handed hitters, two right-handed hitters who can play first base for a few months. Because remember, we've seen it happen. We saw it happen with Alderson. We saw it happen last year with David Stearns. You can recreate your team. If you want to recreate your team, you could do that at the deadline between the All-Star game and the end of July. You can recreate your team, or you could just fill in a hole or two. So they have a situation where they have Meneses they picked up, people that may have gotten yep. some people.
Who was actually very, very good with the Nats a couple of years ago after the Soto trade.
Yeah, he had a couple of good seasons, and he's actually a good hitter at first base. He's fair to Midland. They also have Luke Ritter, who has power numbers. I mean, he had an 830 OPS last year at Syracuse. He's a good right-handed hitter. He's the kind of guy who could display some serious power. And then they have Winker, who's willing to play first base, says he's played it a little bit, not much. And they have Beatty, who could potentially play. So you have two lefties and two righties. And you know what? The other thing about this, and you have it around the infield, is you create competition among your younger players. Don't you think that Vientos was helped by the fact that he was in a competitive environment with Beatty and Mauricio and sure. perhaps some others?
He had to earn every – and that's the thing. I mean, sometimes we get in this modern age of analytics and social media with younger fans, it's like you got to earn positions. I'm going to throw you another name, and I know this is a scrap heap, but he's on the 40-man, and he was playing well in Korea, and I've looked at some of the Baseball Prospectus guys talk him up. And again, he's one of these guys that's always going to get hype because he's an on-base guy with power. But Jared Young, lefty bat, can play multiple positions, a career minor leaguer with the Cubs and the Cardinals, went to Korea last year and put up big numbers, OPS over 1,000. This is a name that I've heard floated around more on the social media circles. And then I think back to Stearns' pedigree. And if you go back to, and again, I'm going to make it clear to the people listening, I'm not trying to justify not signing Pete Alonso here. I think if there's within reason and the Mets have a reasonable deal, they should re-sign Pete Alonso. But there's a guy named Jesus Aguilar that you guys know that came to Milwaukee back when Stearns was around in a similar situation where, you know, he was a no man. He was a no man's land, 27 years old. Cleveland organization, and he wound up hitting 30 home runs, driving 100 runs, and having a couple of good years. Now, he turned into a pumpkin, but he got an all-star nod. He got some MVP votes. It is not, and Stearns has this history where he says, look, I can make up 30-90. Maybe it's not the popular guy. Maybe it's not the guy that wins a home run derby. Shoot, maybe it's not a guy who plays 162 games or does the scoops that Alonso does, but it's first base. It's a fungible position in terms of defense. It's not the most important defensive position in the field. And I'm confident, based on my experience in this sport, that I could do it. Give him credit. I mean, that's why you're paying him $10 million a year. That's why you hired him. That's why you fired Brody Van Wagenen. And that's why you, Billy Epler's not the GM anymore. So I think people forget about that. There's that Jesus Aguilar component where he's found these guys. The Dodgers did it with Max Muncy, Chris Taylor, guys that have had impacts. And then somebody pointed out, and again, I said this in the open on X, and I can't remember their handle. The Dodgers have walked away from Trey Turner. The Dodgers have walked away from Manny Machado. The Dodgers have walked away from some big-time players because they didn't like the terms of the contract. And they actually looked pretty smart on the Turner front. I thought Trey Turner was their best player a couple of years ago. I thought they were nuts for letting him go. Machado's a guy that maybe they saw the work ethic isn't there. And to give him $300 million and $40 million a year is not going to age well. So maybe the Mets are in the same position. And Seager, too. Yeah. And that's a great point. I'm forgetting Seager. And he was a homegrown guy. And he was probably not probably, definitely is a more important part of the field and a better overall hitter than Pete Alonso.
So let me just elaborate a little bit more on the first base situation. So in addition to the two righties, Meneses and Ritter, and the two lefties, Winker and Beatty, here's Ronnie Mauricio sitting on the periphery. Now, there's no way that he's coming back to the Mets before, let's say, the middle of June. He didn't play all last year and had trouble healing from his ACL injury. So here's another guy, and I've been there 2 seasons ago. I was at spring training, and I was standing right next to him. Now, I'm 6'3", about 229. And this guy, I he and we've I think we talked about this before. Players get weighed, measured and weighed when they first get to an organization, and then that kind of sticks. They don't get
Right.
remeasured and weighed. This guy is huge. He had to be close to 6'4". He was taller than me. And he was at least my size. I would say he was somewhere more like 235, but may have been less because there's more muscle. But this is a guy who has soft hands, the body and size, and could easily be a first baseman. I mean, people forget Ernie Banks was an all-star caliber, Hall of Fame caliber shortstop
And he
before he was
finished his
ever
career
moved to
at third
first
at first
base.
base.
That's
Yeah,
right.
yeah, yeah.
And you know, that happened, I think, in 1960 when they moved it to first base. But here's another guy who's a switch hitter who could be in on that mix of now you've got five guys, and you mentioned Jared Young. I see Jared Young more as insurance to be able to trade Jeff McNeil at the deadline, and then Jared Young becomes that utility
Yep,
player
because
to
he could
play
play a
all
bunch
around.
of yeah, he could play a bunch of positions. That's
That's right.
that is really interesting. I think that, and I know we want to get into the Dodgers, and I think that that's part of this conversation with Mets fans because they look at the Dodgers and they say, we need to keep up with the Dodgers. We need to keep up with this team. And right now, Pete Alonso signing him, and again, I'm not one of these guys that likes to go to wins above replacement and win shares and talk about it as gospel because that's just a number. But is a guy that was 2.6 WAR last year, easily made up between some of the names you brought up incrementally. And sometimes that doesn't always work in terms of building a presence in a lineup. But signing Alonso is not going to close the gap from a Dodger team that a couple of years ago won 110 games. Looks like they're going to win that much more. And truthfully, if it's inevitable that you're going to face them in a 5 or 7 game series, either in the division series or the NLCS, and they're going to be the home team. Whether you get there with 89 wins or 95 wins or 91 wins, we care about it as fans because we want to have that season of fun. Nothing is better than 2022, where you knew you were going to make the playoffs. It was just a matter of were you going to win the division or the wild card, and it creates some of that cushion. But Stearns is not looking at it that way. He's looking at, like, how do I build this team up in October, like you just said? And part of that is the assets that you talk, we're not even really talking about the Rule 5 picks. They just signed. He's not going to be an impact this year, but Adbert Ozele from a 2 year minor league deal, form a really top notch arm out of the bullpen, exactly what they need. Low walk rate, high strikeout rate. Who knows? Maybe somebody they look at if Diaz opts out this year to close in the future. They're going to look at a lot of these incremental, and you're a guy that is always looking at the undervalued assets in an organization. So there's a lot here that we're not talking about now that's not sexy that at some point in July we might be actually talking about. And I'll even say something else. I think Minter, if healthy, and Tom Verducci was talking about this on the MLB Network show, I think he's as good as Tanner Scott, to be honest with you, to be.
I think he's close, and for the difference in compensation, I
It's
would say
no, I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, if you have 72 million to burn, here's a guy that walks a lot of guys and 2 years ago was a closer on a bad club in Miami and couldn't get big outs for the fish. So maybe I'm overstating it, but still.
there's another aspect of getting a Minter, and that is that you took him away from the Braves.
Sure. And he
So
knows that team. Yeah.
And that never hurts anybody to take. I mean, because it's a three-way race in the National League East, and the you know part of this the Mets' goal right now. I think this is why I'm very confident in Stearns. The goal isn't. It's not about the World Series. It's about winning your division. Okay, and they have as tough competition across the board as any division, even I would say comparable to the American League East. Although the American League East, I think they have four teams who could potentially threaten the Yankees. But it's really a situation where David Stearns seems to have the peripheral vision, the vision into the future. He's understanding what it takes to get through a season and into the postseason, which he did very well with the Brewers. And that is what we're talking about here. Looking at somebody like a Jesse Winker, and he's not just a DH guy. He's going to serve these other roles that need to be filled. And believe me, when somebody has plantar fasciitis, you know you've got to rest him. And so that Winker becomes a really much more important piece than I think most Mets fans. And you're creating this incredible there's no other position on the Mets team that has as much competition as first base. Now, nobody may have realized that 2 months ago. Certainly nobody realized it at the end of last season. But there is tremendous competition there, and at second and third base. So you have people like Acuna. Here's the sad part. Iglesias did a hell of a job. I mean, wow.
Great hands, great job at third base.
Fun to watch. The guy hit
especially against left-handed pitching. Hit left-handed pitching real and if not for his performance down the stretch in September when McNeil went down, they don't make the postseason. Think about right. that. That's a guy that was signed off the scrap heap in December that you probably figured would spend the year at Syracuse as a backup in case Lindor went down for any period of time. And now he turned out to be a big piece.
A huge piece. And not only that, I mean, talk about his clubhouse acumen and how he blended with the yep. players and the whole thing with the OMG, which was a lot of fun, you have to admit. To me, that was a lot more fun than the grimace. But you have a situation where you have Acuna, who came up to this spectacular job for 10 games, 9 or 10 games, and he has to have a place to play. Clearly, he's not, and then he's also a legitimate shortstop. So if what happened to Lindor happens, which could easily happen, where he misses a week or two or three,
sure,
then you have somebody who could come in there and has the range and the ability and he has good baseball common sense, it appears. So you have somebody who can fulfill every one of those other infield positions. I'm sure he could play third base, but you have guys I didn't even mention for first base, part of that competition, the fact that Vientos could move over there. So if Beatty suddenly started to hit and have a better handle on what it takes to be a major league hitter, excuse me, then I think you have another. There's a sixth guy to throw into that first base.
You're pointing out the variability that I'm uncomfortable with, that the fans are uncomfortable with, that the mainstream media guys, the guys like a Benigno, who I played the clip going in, screaming and yelling at the clouds, Colin Stearns an elitist, are not comfortable with. But we have to be comfortable with. And doing things like this is not necessarily being the Brewers. These are things that I think in a world where Soto's getting $50 million a year, and a Vlad Guerrero Jr. probably will get $45 to $50 million a year. And I think the elite hitters on a team, the price has gone up. When Max Scherzer signed that deal where he was getting $43 million a year a couple of years ago, the cost of starting pitching went up, elite starting pitching. And it's creeping to that $38 to $40. If the luxury tax is at $300, it's actually less. How do you field the team without these guys? You need guys making a couple million a year. You need to have a pipeline. And that was what did the Mets in 06, 07, 08. They didn't have a pipeline on a lot of fronts. In 2015, they had to go out and get a Juan Uribe and guys like that. And that's fine, but you can't every offseason build the team with these expensive pieces, because even a Jesse Winker made about $8 or $9 million a year. And that's the market value for guys like that. Jose Iglesias is a great story. You can't rely on that all the time. You have to have your pipeline. And I think that's where you're going, is be comfortable being uncomfortable with the Mets pipeline. And it'll certainly make for an interesting spring training, I'll tell you that.
Well, what's the use of building a farm system, which they're doing, without giving a chance for those players to play Major League Baseball? I mean,
sure.
You know, it's like people saying they should bring in Bregman. What, are you kidding me? Why would you need to bring in Bregman?
I think he's a bigger risk than Pete. I've heard, look, people say, hey, bring in Bregman, bring in Pete, go all in. And I've been a guy that's been enticed by that. You know, you run the numbers. If Bregman's normal Bregman, they're going to average 5.5 runs a game. Gold glove defense at third base. I don't see the Mets, unless it's an opportunistic deal, doing that. If Bregman falls to them, I don't see them doing that.
He's represented by Scott Boras.
No, and another guy that's sitting around. I mean, yeah. I think this will be the second year in a row. Last year it was the Arms, the Snells, and Montgomery. This will be the second year in a row that Boras is going to grab guys into spring. I think both Alonso and Bregman, if we don't see any movement this coming week to 10 days, I think they're going into spring training without a home. Do you agree?
I think that's possible. I have to believe that one of them is just going to say to him, hey, I want to sign. I don't want to miss one day of spring training. I think when you're playing those infield positions, I think an outfielder can get away with missing a week or 2 weeks of spring training. I don't think anybody else can. Catchers, pitchers, and infielders, man, there's a lot to do. And those guys, I think Bregman's a smart guy. Pete, I don't know why Pete's done this. He had everything to gain by staying with the Mets, because what he's maybe forgetting, although I can't really believe he would forget this, if you set records on a team and you're a lifelong, you know, like David Wright was a lifelong Met, or Derek Jeter was a lifelong Yankee, you're going to be honored for the rest of your life. And you're going to be honored with days in your name and whole name.
And Dave, what if he signs a 3-year deal with $75 to $77 million in Toronto? Maybe he gets a little bit less deferred money. I mean, there's the Canadian taxes. Maybe he goes to Toronto with Vlad next year, and if they keep Vlad, and I could see Toronto saying, look, we'll sign Pete. He'll be the transition from Vlad to Pete. They've missed out on a couple of big free agents. They want to make noise in the AL East while they still have some talented players. But you go to Anaheim, nice place to play. It's California. Maybe in that division they could make noise. Trout gets healthy potentially. But you're kind of going into no man's land. And look, money's money. You gotta maximize your value. But I have a hard time believing the Mets offer is a budget offer that he can't justify versus what the rest of the market is out there.
It's a combination. It's a shocker to him that he's not getting a longer term contract. And there's the situation with Boras, where I could see, after you have several negotiations with Boras, where you're just going, wow, you know, I just put in the time with this guy for several other players, and now he's giving me a pain in the butt on this. And really, I don't like, it's kind of like a little bit of dirty pool. So I don't know why Pete needed Boras. And I think Nimmo, I want to make this point. Nimmo, and this is all speculation based on, I think, some pretty good assumptions. And that is, he went to Boras late, last minute kind of thing, just like Pete did. But I think the difference was, he said to Boras, look, I want to stay a Met for my whole career. So go out there, see what the market is for me. But I don't want this to take a long time, which it didn't. And I want to be with the Mets. And I think he instructed Boras enough so that's exactly what happened. And he got a good deal. He really did. Mm-hmm. But I'm guessing that the market out there for Nimmo wasn't as good as the Mets' interest in him. And I think the same thing could be said of Pete, except Pete and Boras didn't play it that way. And that, I'm sorry, it has to go back to the player.
Sure. He works, the agent works for the player. In this case, though, I think both the agent and the player, total speculation. You fired your representation. By the way, we have no idea what the wife's piece in this is. This. There's been some rumblings the wife wanted him to go with a better agent and things like that. Who knows if that's true? Wife always gets blamed when things go bad, right? In sports. But he's got a family. Who knows what their influence is? At this point, if you pay Boras, whatever you're paying him, and he doesn't come through with what he promised, you essentially wasted your time. There's a lot of egg on the face there. Now, Do you want to ruin the back half of your career over that? If the Angels come out and give him a 4-year, $100 million guaranteed, 25 a year, maybe that's worth it to him. That's not what he wanted, but gets him closer to the guaranteed money that maybe in his mind he'll never get another shot at. Whatever he gets, he's not going to have to work for the rest of his life. Let's put it that way.
We've all done something in life where we put pride instead of our gut feeling or intelligence. And that's certainly at play here. And you know, Pete's probably the kind of guy who's more of taking orders from Scott than giving orders to Scott. So it's just, I don't even want to talk about that anymore, and you probably don't either. I mean, I think there are some exciting things about having this competition at first base. I think it's very exciting because you and I and everybody listening to this podcast are real deep baseball fans. We have a different appreciation, a different take on the game. And, you know, it's like I was much more upset when Strawberry left, let's say, because I thought that was really, you knew that he
and that was ego. Out. That was ego on Frank Cashin. That was ego. And Strawberry to this day said bad move. Now, Strawberry had other demons. Possible they would have came out here in New York. They got exacerbated in L.A. He didn't get along. To this day, he'll tell you, Tommy Lasorda, not his favorite manager. But that's an example where egos got in the way. I don't think egos are in the way on the Mets side. I think the Mets have said, I've done everything I can to make this work. And Pete and Boris are like, hey, this is where we're at. Now, as this comes out, things could transpire today on this Sunday. I don't see this resolving. Now, David, with the whole Dodger thing, you know, you wrote a piece and David Rubenstein of the Orioles came out yesterday advocating for a salary cap. And here's the other part. We may want to enjoy baseball in 2025 and 2026, because when I put that stuff out there on social media, someone wrote, well, you know, make sure you tell everybody on the show to go take a European vacation in 2027 because there ain't going to be any baseball. The Dodgers are taking – here's my position on the Dodgers. They're not breaking the rules. They have built an environment over the course of a decade. This did not happen overnight. Didn't happen in the last couple of years where it's a desired location. Now, L.A. has always been, the West Coast has always been desired because of weather and other reasons in sports. The Western Conference and the NBA, always a desired location. You know, the Lakers, you know, things like that. So I can't criticize them. The Japanese pipeline has been going on with the Dodgers since Hideo Nomo back in 1995. They are now leveraging what they've built over a decade with the Guggenheim Group, with the Equity Group. They have Magic Johnson as a face, even though he acts like he's the owner. He's not. He's only a couple percentage points. I can't begrudge them at all for doing this. They're willing to go and pay the luxury tax penalty and absorb that 90 to 100% tax. So be it. You wrote that we're at a point where this is similar to the 1976, and that's a little different, where Oakland was looking to sell off their big, not even trade, sell off their players to the Yankees and the Red Sox. The Yankees and the Red Sox were very eager to take them, especially George. And the commissioner needs to step in and do something about it. Well, here's what's going to happen. I think you're going to have a very significant lockout in 2027. I think the sport is going to be harmed. I don't know if it's going to be fixed like it was after 94. And there's a lot of metrics that indicate that despite what the players are saying, or the owners are, you know, revenues are, I mean, attendance is not at its peak, but it's still very healthy. Payrolls are, average payroll is $169 million. So it's higher than it's ever been. There's arguments on both sides, but you're taking the piece or the stance that, hey, we're at a dangerous point where this could eliminate big swaths of the country that are non-competitive. And a sport that's a tournament. Remember, it's truly a tournament in October. It does not mean the Dodgers, unlike the NBA, it's truly a tournament. I don't think you could guarantee the Dodgers will navigate the multiple rounds, even though they won't probably have to face the wild card round. There's the division series, there's the LCS, there's the World Series. That's a lot of variability to win three rounds of playoffs in this day and age.
All right, well, you set me up here to start talking about that particular issue. So the best way to eliminate a team like the Dodgers, you know, a team that just marches through the regular season. And I it wouldn't surprise me if the Dodgers won 120 games this year. Really would.
So you think they'll win more than the Mariners, they'll win more than the Yankees of 98, in which nobody said the Mariners or the Yankees were bad for the sport. Keep that in mind.
Or the Mets of 86. Yeah, I do think they'll win more. Because I don't see – I think the Diamondbacks improved a little bit, but I don't think anybody else in that – I think the Padres are not going to be anywhere near as good as they were the last couple of 3 years. And
with the trust, I think they're going to probably cut payroll a lot of ways. Yeah. I think they might be selling people off, which is a whole other thing when you start selling players off.
The Giants seem to have trouble attracting free agents and what have you. And it's a tough ballpark for hitters. But I think when you're running away like that, the only way to knock that team off is to get them in that wild card series, which they're not going to be playing in, because that's when you have – if you have two really good starting pitchers, you can do it. And if you have three, you have an even better chance. But that's what I see happening. So they're going to be sitting there. I mean, would anybody in their right mind bet against the Dodgers being in the World Series, say – three out of the next 5 years? I don't think you'd have.
No, I mean, that's chalk. That's the easy money. I mean, you'd have to invest a lot. You're not going to get a lot back.
But
they've only been to the World Series a couple. Before this year, the World Series they won, I could argue, was, I don't want to say illegitimate. It was that tournament season during COVID. Yeah. They've been knocked out, and they've had good teams, including 2022 when the Phillies knocked them out. Oh no, sorry, the Padres knocked them out, and then the Phillies beat the Padres. They've been knocked out before, and that's the thing about baseball. There's not enough of an incentive to win the division right now.
I understand, but they haven't had a team as deep as this, and nobody has in my lifetime since 1959. I can remember the 1959 World Series. There's been no team, even the Yankees in the early 60s, who were as deep as this Dodgers team appears to be.
That says a lot. That's a very loaded statement, including if you go back to some of those 1950s. They started to decline after 62. Those Yankees teams, I mean, geez, I mean, guys like Johnny Blanchard and Elston Howard didn't even play every day. I mean, that's how crazy true. It was.
You say they declined after 62. In 63, they were in the World Series, got swept, and in 64, they were in the World Series.
Right, but they weren't the same team. They weren't the same team, but you're right. And that's a league where you just win the league. You don't have to go through rounds of playoffs at that point.
But right now, I would bet on the Yankees getting in the World Series. I think the Red Sox, I think there's some good teams in that American League East. I don't see anybody else. Maybe the Rangers, if everything fell into place, or the Astros are some competition. However, the situation is, the small markets, sure, they have a chance to get in the postseason because of the tournament that you're describing. However, I can't for the life of me understand why. If you're a Pirates fan, if you're the Royals have really came up this year and have some outstanding pitching. The Reds, the Mariners, they've never been to a World Series, and they have a great fan base. But there's got to be a point here where you're really putting almost a gun to the head of fans in those cities and saying, there's 10 cities who compete for free agents. Really, that's it. That's right. One third of the total teams in baseball. And you can't let that continue. And it's going to continue unless they make some specific changes that I don't believe are difficult to make. And I don't.
Well, you point out what you're talking about is revise the luxury tax system, eliminate deferred money, have an international draft. So to eliminate, but I'm going to tell you,
Dave, pro draft and amateur draft
Right. So you can't just grab, people from Korea and what happened.
That's correct. And that's part of the big problem with the Dodgers. I'm not aiming this at the Dodgers. The Mets went out. They've been following a kid since he's 12 years old, and they signed him to a $5.6 million contract.
Ilian Pena. Yeah, who might be another Soto. But David, think about it. Mets fans are mad about Sasaki. Imagine if Pena in 5 years is an elite bat, and Sasaki, who we had Jim Allen from Japan say, look, he's a good player, but not fixed. You never know how things turn out. The Mets tried to sign Juan Soto back in the day. They didn't. Imagine if they had signed him out of the international.
Yeah,
You know?
but you can't have the pipeline only going to the biggest teams. And again, I'm aiming this not just at the Dodgers. They didn't do anything illegal. They took advantage of what the rules were. They massaged the rules to get, I mean, the fact that you can put Ohtani into a contract that's worth about $70 million a year and call it 43 or 46 million for luxury tax purposes. I'm sorry, that's not. Now, you could have deferred money to anybody you want. You could set up any kind of contract you want, but it should all be divided by the number of playing years, and that's what the luxury tax is based on. And that, I don't think anybody would say that's not fair. And even the Players Association, they can do the deferred contract, so you're not hurting the Players Association. The other thing is you've got to create a floor. So these teams that aren't spending, which are, there's at least half the teams out there that really don't spend at all. They have to be forced to spend. If they're going to collect luxury tax money, then they've got to spend. Now, if they want to opt out of the luxury tax money, then have your $40 million payroll.
What would your floor be? I'm curious to compare it to last year's payrolls. What would you think today, with today's current dollar value, what would a f appropriate floor be?
I'd say 110 million, give or take 10 million.
So based on your parameters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 teams were below that. In the case of Oakland and Pittsburgh,
Yeah,
significantly,
that's a
Tampa's in
third.
there.
That's a
You know,
third
if
of the
you raise
teams.
that up a little bit, and you're in, and look. If Rubenstein, and I know what fans are going to say, David Rubenstein owns the Orioles. He's worth $4 billion. And my debate on that, and I know Tom Ricketts, the Ricketts family got criticized for some comments at a fan fest saying, hey, we just want to break even. Just because you're worth $4 billion doesn't mean you just sit around with a pile of cash like Scrooge McDuck there. And also doesn't justify losing your family's money at hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Because, by the way, not everybody in the family is cool about paying a bullpen arm at 100% tax, 20 million a year, because you want to get a few outs in August. Like that's you're looking at it from a fan perspective. So I understand that, but if Rubenstein is talking what he's talking about, implementing what the NFL, which I can't see, hard cap, NFL's hard cap and has a floor. So the NFL has the floor like you do, hard cap. I think that what's more realistic is the NBA. The NBA has these aprons. As you get into these aprons, your draft picks are impacted, your player movement is impacted, your ability to pick up on the fringes is impacted. So the Knicks are a perfect example. And they have a superstar in Jalen Brunson who took a discount deal based on his standing in the sport to help mitigate some of that. Think about that. So that's what's going to have to start happening in baseball. Players are going to have to wrap their head around that, which historically never happens with the Players Association, the strongest union in sports. Any kind of, let's say, 300 million is the apron where now you're going to have significant penalties towards roster building. Well, when you have Soto at 50 and you have Lindor at 35, almost a third of your payrolls and two guys. In the NBA, that'll work. In the NFL, you got a quarterback and a running back. You could probably make it work. How do you build a team that way? That's where the farm system and then you have an international draft. Yes, you'll level it out, but are you squeezing the superstar player? Jalen Brunson gave up money. I'm not crying for him. He's still making a lot of money. But he gave up money now, risking injury to help win a championship. Credit to him, but that's not necessarily pro player, that environment. And then you're saying to
No.
yourself, Jim Dolan's making money. Cohen's making money. Why should that be in their pocket and not the player's pocket when the player's the product?
I don't know that. I don't follow the other sports the way I do baseball, but you say Cohen's making money. The Mets, most of these guys who buy baseball teams are looking, it's an investment in the long term. They're looking, I'm going to be into this for 15 years, for 20 years, for 25 years, and maybe longer if I pass on and my family benefits. And when we sell the team, the Wilpons did, they sold it for exponentially, I mean, ridiculously higher than they could have gotten investing that money any other way.
Even with all their debt. Yeah. Even with all their debt. Yeah.
So I think that, I mean, can you imagine if Steinbrenner sold the Yankees now? I mean, he'd clean up. What did his father buy it for in 1973 or four? I mean, it was ridiculously low compared to what he's getting, even if you take the value of money at that time as opposed to now. But because I did this yesterday, I was talking with my son about college debt, and my college debt was like $1,500 coming out of college. And that's worth, now he did his little calculation. He said that's $11,000 now.
Right.
Okay, so that gives you some idea of the difference between 1975 and currently. But these guys are in it for the long haul, most of them. I don't even know one who's been in for the short haul. Look, McCourt ran the Dodgers into the ground.
Sure.
And the Dodgers took a long time to recover from that. And they did some, you know, it's funny. At the beginning of the new regime, they made a few mistakes, overpaid guys, and then they started building the farm system so they could do what the Padres are probably, Preller does this probably more than anybody else. He just doesn't believe that any prospect is going to come to fruition for his major league team. So, but he uses them as capital to get other players. Right. And so I think that you have to open up the playing field. It's not only leveling it. First, you have to open it up so it does level. And the only way to do that, it's not a one-part thing. It's not a two-part. It's a three-part thing that starts with, well, you could say it starts with getting rid of the deferred money, which I think is so easy to do. It really is easy to do because you're not hurting anybody by saying the deferred money cannot be considered in the luxury tax.
So now, sure.
You could have as many, you could have 26 deferred contracts on your major league team. It's not hurting the players. Okay, secondly, the luxury tax system is actually set up now to handle this. I'm not really saying it has to change that system. The only thing it has to do is create a floor. And again, a team can opt out of it, but then they can't collect luxury tax benefits. And the same thing, there's no cap.
And that's what Dave Roberts kind of danced around. You'll hear the clip coming, you know, you guys heard the clip coming into the show that they're not using the money. Do you think teams like Tampa use the money appropriately, even though we don't see ball players from it? I think they do just by outside observation because of the ability to compete.
I think Tampa is an outlier to everything because they've been so aggressive at development, so aggressive at keeping their farm system, you know, competitive, and really trying to find those diamonds in the rough from the other systems. I think there are other teams that are better examples of not spending. And of course, you know, I feel bad for what happened in Tampa. You know, this past year I was at like 16 or 17 games.
Yeah, I was there meeting you. We went to go watch the Mets play the Rays in that horrible series, but it was fun seeing you there.
And you know, their stadium took a lot of knocks, but actually they put on it was a fun show going to the games. It was air conditioned in a place where I don't know how you play baseball if it's not air conditioned.
Right.
But I think that it's, you're not hurting any team by creating this floor and allowing them to opt out. Secondly, the third part of this is that, and it's so important, is that they've been talking about an international amateur draft for 4 decades.
And I think that's the easy fix, though. I don't, why would the players, I guess that their fee is going to keep salaries down?
I don't know why. And I'm not sure that the players association objects to that. I don't know what the inside is there.
I mean, maybe you put like each, like they do with the amateur draft, this is your slot fee, what you could get.
Well, one thing you have to do is you have to raise the age to 17, just like, so you have to be 17 and you have to be provably 17 because there's a lot of guys.
Just like the NBA. Well, the NBA, I think, did 19 for a while, 18. Yeah, I mean, that's, but see, with South America, I mean, who the hell knows?
But they can. Listen, man, Major League Baseball has investigators that go down and check, and so do all the teams have investigators they call upon. Most of them are former FBI agents, and they go out and they examine things that need to be examined. Look, I mean, what happened with Juan DeFranco is just a shame for the Rays.
Sure.
And you know, it could have been found out. Part of it is that they were on him and all these guys from such a young age that it really doesn't make any sense. But the other part of that is they have to have an amateur pro draft. And we're seeing that now every year. We're seeing, and it's going to happen more. The Japanese players, the Korean players are now coming in. We're going to have some players probably coming out of the Taiwanese league. And you know, in Czechoslovakia and Germany, baseball is becoming more popular. We're going to have the next 5 years is going to be European players coming out. And so having a professional draft of international players, and let's say Tom Smith goes over from, who's an American or a Canadian, goes over to play in the Korean league. Well, he's got to be part of that draft too, because there's a lot of guys. Look, Miles Mikolas.
Jared Young was in Korea.
That's right.
That signed him. Yeah. He would have to go in the draft, and teams would have to, you know, base it on. So are you opposed, if they could come to some kind of reasonable, are you opposed to aprons with this penalties? I mean, there's really aprons now with luxury tax, but significant penalties to team building like the NBA, where you can't make certain types of trades. I'm not going to get deep in the weeds with the NBA salary cap because it's tough. Certain trades are made, certain free agents you can't sign, certain contract structures. If you make a trade, you have to make trades in a certain way. Draft pick penalties. Are you in favor of that? And then adding these other ideas that you talked about, you talk about a luxury tax thing, but I'm talking about, I think the owners want to look at what the NFL has hard cap, and that's their nirvana. That ain't going to happen. The NBA, I think, and the aprons, I think that's where this is going. And I think that's where the Players Association has to say, can we do those kind of penalties and still get Juan Soto $50 to $55 million a year? Because if the answer is no, we're headed towards an ugly situation. And I got to tell you something, David. I got a nephew who's going into high school, plays basketball. He doesn't hate baseball, but he's not ingrained in the sport like you and I were at that age. And that's a problem. And then I go and I listen to these consultants. I recently had a consultant I talked to who thinks the solution is the Savannah Bananas. And I'm looking at him like, okay, like now we're going to the other way. We're doing like the Harlem Globetrotters. And you're telling me you want the sport to be this? Like that. If that's where the sport's going, then it's like a movie. It's like a circus. Like, I don't want to go to the circus 81 times a year. That's nice once in a while, every couple of years, or, you know, as a break. So, like, we got all these things, and I think you've got owners. Dave, you know this. You've got owners. They're hawks. They're going to try. They hate Cohen. They hate what the Dodgers are doing. You know, Hal is kind of like, where is he? Because he would love to have some cost certainty. Other than Cohen and the Dodgers, maybe Middleton with the Phillies, who knows? I don't think there's a lot of support to keep things status quo. I think we're headed for a real ugly scenario. And I don't know if we're going to have much of a baseball season in 2 years. I really don't.
Well, I would say that would be probably because of the Players Association. But what I would like to see is what I'm suggesting, I don't believe hurts the Players Association, because I'm not suggesting a hard.
No, game. You're pretty benign. I think the owners want to go Armageddon. Like if Reinsdorf is still around, they still remember 94. They wanted to go Armageddon. They thought they could break the union. They did in 94, 95. They want to do it now, and the stakes are much higher. And I think there are owners that would be very comfortable, like the NHL in 04. Losing a season to prove a point. I mean, a total blackout. I'm talking, I see what happened to the NHL 20-something years ago happening to baseball in 2 years. I really do. And I think they cannot survive in this current environment losing a full season. I'll come back. You'll come back. A lot of people that won't. And it's good. And I don't think you have Sammy Sosa and McGuire to save you this time. The sport itself will have to save itself.
I think that's a bit of a heinous way to look at it, but I could see where it's coming from and why. I think that it's going to take some sober minds to sit across the table and say, okay, start out by saying, we have to make sure that we don't get into a situation where we're putting the sport on the shelf and allowing us to lose a fan base and a certain type of fan base, which, by the way, and you alluded to it, is the younger fan base, the fan base that's probably, you know, past somewhere 18 to 45. You don't want to lose that fan base.
No.
And maybe it could go younger than that. But I don't think that has to happen. And nothing that I suggested in my piece, I think, would add to that. I think it would help that scenario.
I agree. I think you're very rational, and I don't think there's a lot of owners that are.
Well,
Colorado, another one. My thing,
and that's why I originally titled that an open letter to Rob Manfred, was the commissioner has to – now, that this is what people, you know, who aren't as old as I am, and that includes you, because you weren't cognizant.
I was too young. I was just basically being conceived at that point.
I mean, Bowie Kuhn wasn't a particularly great commissioner, but he did one great thing, and that was – when he saw that this was going to be bad for the game in every sense of the word, just selling off, because what a lot of people don't know, the A's had a bit of a dynasty where they had a 5-year postseason run. 3 of those years, they won the World Series. I think 4 of them, they were in the World Series. And it was a travesty that he was selling off all of these players. And I'm talking about his absolute best players, and, you know, the people. I think the final straw was when he was selling Vita Blue and a couple of others.
Sure.
And you know, it was just horrible for the game, horrible for Oakland. And he stepped in and did what he had to do, because a commissioner of baseball has absolute power. Yep. He can do anything he wants.
It's a monopoly. They have antitrust exemption. They can
That's
do whatever
correct.
They want.
And he didn't step... He took the heinous step of saying no, and these guys actually had to go back. I can't remember if one or two of them actually appeared in uniform for the new team and had to go back to the A's. But that's what has to happen now. And I don't think what Manfred has to do is anywhere near as tough as what happened with Bowie Kuhn in those days. So. But is he going to do it? No, I don't think he is. So what's going to happen is this is all going to fall out on the negotiating table at the next contract negotiation with the MLBPA. And then it gets into a situation where I'm not sure if I own, I'm a small business owner, but I don't want people telling me what I have to do all the time with my business. I mean, as long as I'm following the law and I'm, sure. Being sensible and you know, it's about creativity. A business owner has to constantly be creative, and you have to keep massaging what you're selling so that it reaches the most people possible in your niche. So, you know, baseball has a much bigger niche than, say, what I do or what you do. Oh, actually, what some of the things you do have a pretty big niche. But I think that that we have to be sensible. And I'm hoping that they can be sensible based on what happened.
I hope so. I'm very worried. I think there's a lack of faith in Manfred. I didn't like Bud Selig. I thought he was a corrupt guy. I think he, you know, did things that favored him and his legacy. And I think he held the sport back at times. But I give him credit. He was able to, after 94... which he was part of that collusion that led up to that, collusion one, collusion two, collusion three. He was right there with them. And I don't like how he kept the Wilpons afloat, but he was able to keep that sport going and see a tremendous growth to where he left it in a good place. And I'm not sure we've seen the same curation of the sport. And I think we'll see. This is going to be probably Manfred's last negotiation. And the Dodgers are going to be, and if the Dodgers are coming off back-to-back or a three-peat like the Yankees did back in the 90s, then the calls are going to be that much louder. And it'll be really interesting. I think 2027 is going to be a very interesting, historic year in baseball. And I hope that they have a more sensible solution to your point, what you put out there. I'm afraid that we're going to lose a season like the NHL, and that you and I are going to be spending the summer talking about maybe the 2025 world champion Mets, or, you know, we'll go back in time and, you know, cause I can't do CBA talk, but you're right. You know, I entered the clip entering in the show was basically the legal case, Charlie Finley versus Bowie Kuhn in baseball. And it was determined that the commissioner could do whatever he wants. So if the commissioner says the Dodgers are bad for baseball, now there's a CBA, so there's some limitations to what you could implement as per the CBA. And I don't think he could have stopped Sasaki from signing or them signing Yates at this point, but he has to start thinking about what the penalties are for largesse. And if you go to Talking Mets Beyond the Mic, you have some great solutions. So what do you got? Anything you want to part, any parting shots you got for us here as we wrap up?
I just want to throw one thing in on that. It's not about the Dodgers. It's about the rules being changed so that a team like the Dodgers or the Mets or the Yankees can take advantage of it. It's kind of like it's like slapping the fans of all these other teams. And again, one, I know somebody who keeps telling me, but it's about the teams that aren't spending. Actually, a few people saying that. Yes, it is. But it's not about the Dodgers. It's about the rules, and that you have to tighten rules when people take advantage of the loopholes in the rules. And that's all. So there are other things I wanted to mention. For one thing, I thought the Rule 5 draft in December was really interesting. The Mets lost. They were only one of two teams that lost two players in the major league portion of that draft. And they lost somebody who I really liked was Nate Lavender, and to the Rays, and they lost Mike Vassell to the Phillies, who then was traded to the Rays, which doesn't happen very often in the Rule 5 scenario. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure what happens if he doesn't latch on to a roster spot. Does he go back to the Phillies or does he go back to the Mets? I'm totally unclear on that and can't seem to get an answer. I'm sure there is an answer. The other thing is that in this other phase of that draft, which is a minor league, they call it a triple-A draft, is that the Mets lost six players, four of whom were pitchers, and of course the two in the major league were pitchers. So they lost six of the eight players they lost overall were pitchers, which kind of says something about what the Mets have always been, and that is a system that kind of puts out there a lot of pitching. And they only picked up one player, and this was in the minor league portion. But I kind of see him as a really interesting pickup, and another guy that makes me say, "Oh, David Stearns knows what he's doing. David Stearns has, this peripheral vision for some talent that's maybe hidden from other people." They picked him up from the Dodgers, Michael Hobbs, he's an overhand, straight overhand pitcher. Who shapes so many shapes on his pitches that it blows my mind. Now he has a two-seamer kind of cutterish. He has a four-seamer that he could throw high in the zone. He has some really interesting stuff and probably should stay away from some of his breaking balls and off-speed pitches. And I think that's what the Mets like, the shape and the fact that he had the hard stuff that plays
Yeah, I
so
think they
well.
like sliders and two seamers, from what our buddy Eddie Dove said.
And
Sliders and two seamers. Or
he
the
has
two
a
seamers are called cutters now. Sweepers are called, I don't know what the hell they call them. Whatever they call them now. So.
it could get a little confusing. I will say that he's probably going to end up being having the two types of fastballs and the sweeper. And if the Mets can really fine-tune that, man, his home run rate is really small. His strikeout rate is really high. His problem, which the Mets have seemed to have last year, was too many walks. But he's a guy who could, Michael Hobbs, keep your eye on him. I think he'll go right to, he's either going to go to Binghamton and make a quick move to AAA, or he'll go right to Syracuse. So that's interesting. And the guys they lost, I would say, other than Lavender, maybe Vassell were pretty marginal, but it was kind of one of those under the radar things. But when you lose that many players, your system's doing something right, and your scouts are doing something right.
Absolutely.
The other
Absolutely.
thing is, that I think the guy who has the most upside of the young players on the Mets who has to perform is Alvarez, and even there, the Mets actually have competition for him if the next season or two doesn't go well. They have Dalverson Gutierrez, who I think is their number one catching prospect right now, and very, very close behind Eovany Rodriguez, whose arm is like a cannon. I might even throw the ball better than Torrens. So Torrens is a terrific thrower of the baseball. And then they have Ronald Hernandez, which I would rank number three. Really good hitter, can can put the ball all over the field. Catching needs some development, but a really interesting hitter with some speed. He could steal bags, and he knows how to run the bases. And then they have Christopher Suero. Now I'll get into something on those two guys in a second. And then I would say Kevin Parada rounds it out. I just don't know. You know, he's improved his catching, but he could be, you know, a guy who ends up being a platoon DH as a right-handed hitter, or maybe and also gives you that third string catcher. I think we're going to see more teams looking for somebody who's a bench player or a DH guy who can get behind the plate in an emergency. So that's some competition they have out there for Alvarez, which he should be conscious of to a certain degree. Now that leads into something that I think Mets fans in the New York area really are sitting on, a really great baseball opportunity this coming season. The Brooklyn Cyclones might be the most exciting minor league team in the whole minor league universe.
And full season now. So you get it from April, even in the cold. It's a little cold to go to Coney Island in April, but still.
And the reason is because there are 14 players on that team who are real, honest to goodness prospects. Many of them are going to, we'll go into this in the next month. I'll do another preview of their prospects, but they have seven pitchers and seven position players. Those two catchers are Hernandez and Christopher Suero, who's from the Bronx, both 21 years old. Then they have in the infield, they have four infielders who I think are all prospects of the top 15 position players on the Mets, and Jacob Reimer, Jesus Baez, Boston Barrow, and William Lugo, who's a power threat. These guys, I mean, this is going to be very, very exciting. And then their organizational player of the year is going to probably be their left fielder or center fielder, and that's Nick Morabito, who's a nephew of Mickey Morabito, who used to play for the Phillies. And then on the pitching side, Calvin Ziegler, Jack Weniger, Greg Lewis, Saul Garcia, high 90s fastball, Eli Ankeny, he missed all of last year. They have two left-handed relievers who could be, including Ankeny and Ryan Ammons, and then Matt Allen, who was drafted in 2019.
Everybody forgot about him, but now he's back. Yeah,
that's right. He was from Florida, kind of near where
Boris Klein. Maybe Boris will want a 10-year, $300 million deal if he has a good season.
I got to see him throw at a nearby place where my son worked out, and he was pretty impressive. But, you know, we're going back to before he had the Tommy Johns and the various other injuries. So if you're in the New York area and you can't afford to go to Citi Field, Yankee Stadium, because it costs, boy, get out there and go to
get out to the Cyclones. It's a good, especially in the summer. It's a good. Well, listen, we could go on and on. You just gave Mets fans hope. Maybe Pete Alonso's not going to be signed. Maybe Baseball Armageddon's coming in a couple of years. But the Mets have a better pipeline, and that's why we do this show, and that's why shows like this and sites like this and the other sites in the Mets community are so important. So we'll do this again. We're looking forward to more from you, and thanks so much, my friend.
Mike, if I could just do a quick shout out.
Sure. Absolutely.
I have a dear friend who was the Mets general manager in the 1970s and the Cardinals general manager in the 1980s.
I know who you're bringing up. Yeah,
it was Joe McDonald, who a lot of fans will remember who were our ages, that he traded Tom Seaver. But I have to tell you, it was against his. He did not want to trade Tom Seaver. He was forced to trade Tom Seaver by M. Donald Grant. And Joe, unfortunately, lost his wife last week, Virginia, the wife of 43 years. And I want to shout out to Joe. What a great guy. He's 95 years young, sharp as a tack, knows his baseball, started as a ticket taker at Ebbets Field, and then also worked for the LPGA between the Dodgers leaving and the Mets coming into existence. A super guy, great. Some of the best stories I've ever heard. I mean, he drove Ty Cobb around. He knew Willie Mays, gave him a television. I mean, there's just a million great stories. I hope you can have him on the show sometime.
I would love to have him. Yeah, that's going back in baseball history, and that's a long life. 95 years young. If I could be 95 and I could still be on doing this thing, man, I'll sign up for that now. But thanks for that shout out, Dave. You've been great. Great conversation. I love catching up with you. Let's do this again, my friend. All righty?
Right, here, Mike. Thank
All right.
You.
That's David Mills, our good friend David Mills, contributor over at Talking Mets Beyond the Mic. Part two went a little longer. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. We'll see. Look, spring training just a couple of weeks away. I know it's still cold. It's been a cold week here in New York, but baseball's around the corner. I think Amazing Day was a good start to what will be an exciting 2025 season. So anyway, you can check me out, of course, all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And don't forget the newsletter for less than the cost of a cup of coffee. And I was at Starbucks yesterday, and it truly is less than a cup of coffee. You can get me at Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG and get great premium content from guys like me and David Mills and so on and so forth. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.